Hello, everybody. My name is David Friedman. I teach a course here every other year on economic analysis of law, and today is the Cliff Notes version. Let me start by saying a little bit about what economics is, because that's something that everybody knows and they're almost all wrong. People generally think of economics as something like the study of the economy or the study of money, whereas a lot of economists, including I think almost everybody who does law and econ, think of economics as a way of understanding behavior and a way which one can at least try to apply to pretty nearly everything, so that you can use economics to try to make sense of marriage, of why divorce rates are higher than they used to be, of child rearing, of politics, of why tariffs get passed, for example, and of a lot of other things, including essentially all of law. What is special about the economic approach to understanding behavior? It is a single assumption which we call somewhat deceptively rationality. And what we mean by rationality is not that everybody gets out a spreadsheet and adds up costs and benefits every time he's trying to decide whether to buy a hamburger or not, but rather that the best way of describing behavior is to assume that people will tend to take the actions that achieve their objectives. That people have things they want, and the way to predict what they'll do is to say they, our best guess is they'll take the act that best achieves what they want. They might do it by explicit rational analysis. They might do it by trial and error. If the choice is being made not by a person but by a bird, it might have been programmed to act rationally by evolution. That is, have hardwired into it behavior patterns that resulted in achieving evolution's objective, which is reproductive success. Of course, that's true of us too, but that would be another subject. But in any case, that's the assumption. It's not a perfect way of describing behavior. In particular, it's not the best way of describing your behavior, because you have the job of trying to figure out how to be rational or how to achieve your objectives. And you probably know something about your own form of irrationality. I have observed, for example, that even though I'm overweight, if there's a bowl of potato chips next to me, it mysteriously vanishes. And I try to deal with this by not having bowls of potato chips next to me. So that would be an example where, for myself, where I have a more detailed story, I can use something even better than rationality, namely knowing my own irrational pattern. But I can't do that for the rest of you, so rationality is a pretty good way of understanding behavior. What does all that have to do with law? And my standard example, one which I start a book with more or less, is to imagine that you're in a legal system where the most severe punishment is life imprisonment. And somebody says, you know, armed robbery is a terrible crime. We ought to give life for armed robbery. And a legal philosopher says, is this just? And a constitutional scholar says, is this cruel and unusual punishment? And an economist says, do you really want armed robbers to routinely kill their victims? Because after all, if the punishment for armed robbery and the punishment for armed robbery plus murder are the same, the additional punishment for the murder is zero, and if you kill somebody, he can't identify you in a police line. All right? So that's a very simple example where we're looking at a question of a legal rule in terms of how will rational people trying to achieve their objectives, presumably armed robbers prefer not to go to jail, how will they respond to this rule, and judging it on that basis. Let me give a different example, and it's one which I don't know if you've discussed in class or not, but as you all know, criminal law and civil law have different standards of proof. That criminal law, in theory at least, is beyond a reasonable doubt, whereas civil law is preponderance of the evidence. The question is why? And when you put that question to people, they may say something like, well, criminal punishment is more serious. But of course it isn't true, because even very minor criminal punishments are given, are supposed to be given at least, by the same criminal standard. And there are some civil judgments, you know, $50 million say, which to most of us represents more than 2 weeks in jail. So then you start thinking about it, and part of the economist's answer is that the typical civil, quote, punishment, unquote, tort judgment, is a money transfer. One person loses the money, someone else gets it. The putting aside the cost of the trial and all that stuff, the net cost of that is zero. I pay $10,000 in damages, you collect $10,000 in damages. The typical criminal punishment is something like imprisonment or execution. With execution, I lose one life, nobody gets that life. So there is a net cost of punishment equal to the amount of punishment. Imprisonment is even more inefficient than execution, if you think about it as punishment cost relative to amount of punishment. Because not only do I lose a year of my time spent in jail, the rest of you have to pay for the jail cell. All right. So the net cost of imprisoning somebody is more than 100% of the deterrent, so to speak, more than 100% of the cost imposed on a guy who's just convicted. Well, if you're using relatively low-cost punishments, you can afford mistakes. Because if you have mistakes in the civil system, once in a while I pay you $10,000 I shouldn't have, and once in a while you pay me $10,000 you shouldn't have. On the other hand, if we have a high level of mistakes in the criminal system, once in a while I get executed when I shouldn't have, once in a while you get executed when you shouldn't have, those don't cancel out. So that suggests, now it's obviously I'm giving you a very simplified sketch, but it suggests that that way of thinking about it might inform this sort of very central issue about our legal system of why we have different standards of proof. A different way of putting a good deal of the economic analysis is that we're thinking of law as incentive. We are saying, given this legal rule, how will you respond? I like to put it, the story, in terms of the gentleman who goes off mountain climbing with his rich uncle and takes advantage of a convenient opportunity to push him off a cliff. And by great ill fortune, there happens to be a bird watcher on the next cliff over with his camera pointed in the wrong direction, with the result that the murderer gets charged and convicted. And after he's been convicted, but before he's been sentenced, his lawyer says to the judge, Your Honor, I would like to point out that my client has no more rich uncles, so he can't kill any more rich uncles. And if he did have any more rich relatives, we can be sure they will not go mountain climbing with him. Hence, no good will be done by imprisoning or executing my client. He's never going to commit this crime again. So therefore, now that we've settled the fact that he's guilty, please send him home. What's wrong with that argument? And there are a number of things one might say are wrong. One might say it's morally wrong. He deserves punishment. But the economist's answer, and this is also a very old legal answer, well before we had formal economic analysis of law, is that the punishment is aimed at the next nephew who might want to push his rich uncle off the cliff. That the objective of this is to establish a legal rule such that people will know what will happen if they do this and therefore won't do this. There's some quote I've forgotten from one of the common law judges in the 19th century saying essentially that. But in that sense, the economic approach is a forward-looking, not a backward-looking approach to the law. Rather than saying the central question is how do we untangle this mess created by something that's gone wrong, which obviously is a question that sometimes has to be settled, we say the central question is how does the way in which we untangle this mess prevent such messes from occurring in the future? Does our resolution of this conflict affect people's behavior in ways that will, in some sense, achieve whatever we setting up the legal system want to achieve? Now that gets to an obvious question, which is what are we trying to achieve? And I like to think of law and econ as involving three different projects. The simplest project is simply saying, if you have some legal rule, what will the effect be? And that doesn't involve any normative issues at all. It doesn't involve deciding what ought to be. It's just a positive scientific question. Can we figure out what will happen if we have the English standard of the English rule instead of the American rule for who pays for lawyers' costs, or if we have civil forfeiture, or if we have any other legal rule. The second issue is, can we explain what the law is? Can we think of the law itself as produced by people trying to achieve something? And the most famous project along this line, one which has been central to law and econ but doesn't have to be, is a conjecture by Judge Posner made long ago, which was that the common law is economically efficient. And I'm not going to go into any detail on what that means because that would take half an hour, but think of economically efficient as meaning maximizing the size of the pie. Somehow, in some way that I'm not going to explain, on net makes people better off. And so Posner says if you look at the rules of the common law, they look like the rules you would get if a good economist looks at the legal system and says, what rules would maximize the class of the pie? That's a conjecture. It's not at all clear that it's true. If you read my book, Law and Order, I, at the end of it, sort of have, in my final chapter, sum up evidence both for and against that conjecture. But it's been a very productive conjecture, because it gets people thinking about the question, in any of all possible areas of the law, what would the efficient legal rule be? Sometimes it seems to fit the common law rules, sometimes not. You could imagine a different version of that. I don't think I know of any, but you could imagine, let us say, a Marxist who says the law is designed to enrich the ruling class. That would be another predictive theory. You could try to look at legal rules and see if that fits that pattern and so forth. And I'm sure there are other ones you can think of. Some people might say the law has obviously been designed to minimize the size of the pie. I mean, look at how much energy we waste doing each other, at least American law. So, third possible project is to decide what the law should be. So that if, for example, you think that maximizing the size of the pie is a good idea, then the same tools that Posner is using to figure out whether the common law is efficient could be used to say, well, if it isn't, let's make it efficient, or legislative law. So those are three different projects. It's easy to confuse them because the second and the third look a lot alike, but in fact, and Posner pretty clearly, both believe that the common law tended to be efficient and that that was a good thing, but those are actually two separate claims. Let me take a very simple example, and one of the ones which does support his view of the subject, and that's the basic structure of court law. That we have a problem which economists refer to as externality, and the problem is that I am taking an action which affects both me and you. And we will assume that I don't require your permission to take it. All right, hiring you affects me and you, but I can only do it if you're willing, unless I'm the army and we have a draft, or unless I'm the legal system and we have a draft for the juries. But for most employment contracts, require consent by the employee. So suppose I can take an action which imposes, which costs me something to pay, provides me some benefit, but it also imposes costs on you. For example, I am living in London. I can burn coal in my fireplace. That puts smoke into the air and contributes to London fogs, which were famously dangerous in the late 19th century. I make my decision in terms of my costs and benefits. So I say, well, the cost to me of this coal is £5 a year. The benefit of heating my house in that way instead of some other less effective way is £6 a year, so it's worth it to me to do it. But suppose the cost to the other inhabitants of London is another £4 a year just for my coal, making things a little bit worse. In that case, net cost is 9, benefit 6, net loss 3. We're adding up effects, so all of us were worse off when I burned that coal, and yet I'll do it. That's the externality. There are positive externalities, right? You're something that benefits other people, and now the problem is I have too little incentive to do it, so maybe I won't do it, even if including the benefits of that mission. So think of tort law as a mechanism for solving that problem. Because the simple solution, this is what economists call a Pigouvian tax, because an economist in the 1930s called Pigou came up with the idea, is to say, when I will burn that coal, the government will tax me £4. It will tax me their estimate of the cost I'm imposing on other people. Now, if even though I'm going to pay those costs, it's still worth doing it, fine, I'll do it. Sure, I'm imposing costs on other people, but net benefit is positive. On the other hand, now it's in my interest to decide not to do it if that cost is negative. And if you pay attention to the whole controversy over cap and trade and carbon tax taxes, it's all, from economists' standpoint, an argument put in those terms, even though it's not at all clear that what actually comes out of Congress makes any sense in those terms. That's the theoretical argument. Think of tort law as a mechanism for imposing a Pigouvian tax. All right, I take an action. It imposes a cost on you. You sue. I must make the victim whole. What does that mean? It means I've got to pay to him the amount of damage I did to him. Since I know that's going to happen, I take, hopefully I know that's going to happen if the legal system is functioning smoothly, I know that'll happen. So I take into account the external cost that I'm imposing on people in deciding whether to take action. All right. So in that sense, it does indeed look very much like a system designed by an economist to get efficient outcomes. Get people only to take action if net benefits to everybody affected are larger than that cost. Now, that's a very sketchy description. There are lots of things wrong with it, which I'm not going to go into today. But at least gives you some feel for how you can think of conventional elements of the legal system as designed to produce efficient outcomes. It's designed to get people to make those choices that produce net benefits. Everyone affected. There is, however, a different approach to doing the same thing, which is also embedded in our legal system. And that's property laws rather than liability laws. Because suppose that what I'm considering doing is borrowing your car. And one legal rule, the equivalent of tort law for that, would be to say I can hotwire your car, drive it off to the airport, leave it in the parking lot, and you then sue me for whatever the inconvenience was to you as a result of my taking your car. And if legal systems work perfectly, if it costs nothing at all to sue people, and if we always knew we'd taken the car, and imagine all of the practical problems with that system eliminated, it would work. I'd only steal cars when the value to me was more than the cost to the victim, and then the victim gets compensated when I pay him damages, sort of an odd system. You could imagine working it that way. But we actually do it by another system which works much better, and that is that if I want to use your car, I got to get your permission to use it. I've got to borrow your car or rent your car. All right. Well, but that also, in principle, provides a second solution to the same problem. Because after all, if the convenience to me of having your car tomorrow is greater than the inconvenience to you, I'll be willing to offer you a price you're willing to accept. And again, we get the efficient outcome, which is that it gets used by me if it's worth more to me, by you if it's worth more to you. So you can think of the solution to that set of problems, as it were, built into our legal structure as having two variants. One of them is tort law liability, and one of them is property law, property contract, that sort of stuff. Each of them would work perfectly in a world where there were no transaction costs, courts made no mistakes, and so forth. And if you try to figure out why we have property law for some things and liability for others, it makes some sense to say that we use property rules in the cases where the costs of arranging the transactions aren't too high, and or where the costs of handling it through liability would be very high, and vice versa the other way. So that if you take about the case of the car, if I want to have your car, I've got to buy it from you, and bad things happen to me if I just take it. If I want to impose some probability of denting your car, which I do every time I pull out of my driveway, it would be very costly to say that before I'm allowed to drive, I must contract with everybody in San Jose, Santa Clara, and Sunnyvale to get their permission to impose a small risk of denting their car, which I do by driving. So we say instead, the one time in 5,000 that I do that, somebody's car, he sues me, or my insurance company, and we handle it that way. All right. So if you think about the sort of very simple question of why we allocate the use of a car by a property rule, the imposing of risks via driving by a liability rule, I think it gives you some idea of the sort of economic approach to making sense of the legal system. And I think that helps suggest why Posner's conjecture is not an absurd conjecture, although it's not entirely clear if it's true. Let's talk a little bit more about property, because the natural response of a lot of non-economists to having a system of private property is, isn't that a crazy idea? Look, if I need something, why shouldn't I just use it? Why do we have all this business about every single object in the universe is tied to somebody and has somebody's name on it, and then anytime anybody wants to use something, they've got to go to the person who owns it and says, here, I'll offer you some payment for using it. Seems like a sort of a clumsy system, and I think a lot of utopians have imagined something else. The economist's response is the opposite. The economist makes the opposite mistake. The economist says, look, I've just shown you why property is this wonderful, elegant way for moving everything to its highest valued use. If the car is worth more to me than to you, I buy it from you. If it's worth more to him than to me, he buys it from me. I never buy it from you because he outbids me when we're bidding with you. So since we've shown that this is the way of allocating things, let's use it for everything. Nothing should be a commons. Nothing should be anybody can take it who wants. That's just silly. That just leads to not producing things worth producing. Because, of course, the other half of the property rule is that not only does it allocate things, since when you bring something into production, when you write a book, it belongs to you. So now you've got the right incentive to produce things because you can sell them to the highest valued user for whatever. Highest valued user for whatever he values them. So, silly, no comments. And I say, well, wait a minute, let's try just for fun applying that to a really important piece of property in the world, namely the English language. The English language wasn't dropped out of heaven. It was created by human beings embedding words, using words. It's clear that the fact that it's treated as a commons, right? I can use it, you can use a word for the first time and I can just steal it from you. I can use it myself, no problem at all. The fact that we treat it as a commons clearly results in an inefficient quality, an inferior quality of the English language. And the striking example of that is the lack of gender-neutral pronouns in English. The fact that if I want, whatever, I'm writing something, and I want to refer to somebody of indefinite gender, someone who might be male or female, what are my choices? I can write he or she, which is clumsy. I can write he, which will get me jumped upon by all the people who object to that old default rule. Or if I'm really brave, I can invent or find somebody else who's invented some clumsy phrase, term which is supposed to be a new word that nobody will understand and use. Now, if only language were private property, there would be an enormous incentive to figure out a set of gender indefinite pronouns that were euphonious, that fit people, you know, like Ms. Right? Ms is this wonderful example because it worked. All right, it just came up and it's a solution to a similar problem. That was a marital indefinite label. So there'd be a real incentive to do it because once you come up with it, everybody who used that word from thereafter would have to pay you 5 cents each time he did, and you would be very, 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 very rich. So that's an example where there would be some advantages if it were a private property system rather than a commons. But if you think about it, I don't believe they would outweigh the disadvantages, because every time you wanted to speak or write, you would have to first locate the owner of every word you were going to use and buy permission from it. And I think it would be a very quiet world. Right? So that suggests, along the lines that I was just suggesting with cards, that there is some reason why it makes sense to treat some things as commons and some things as property. And that basically where the transaction costs of allocating stuff via the property rule, via it belongs to someone who needs permission to use it, where those transaction costs are very high, that's an argument in favor of a commons. On the other hand, where the benefits of the property rule, getting things produced that are worth producing, getting things used by the highest valued user and so forth, where those are high, that's an argument for a property. So if you think about language, like other forms of intellectual property, has the interesting characteristic that my using it doesn't stop you from using it, unlike cards. So that means that one of the functions of property rules doesn't really exist for language or for other forms of intellectual property, namely allocating them to the highest valued user, because everybody can use it. Right? Everybody can read the same book. Everybody can watch the same movie. The DVD the movie is on should be private property because only one person can watch it at a time, but the content from that standpoint should be. Right? So as this suggests, once you start thinking about the question of why are some things private property and why should some things be property and some not, that gets you into a useful way of thinking about intellectual property law. And one of the things that probably nobody, I'm guessing you've never had discussed in a class, is why are patent law and copyright law so different? They come out of the same sentence in the Constitution, rules radically different, and as I've spent part of a chapter in my book, Law and Order, arguing, if you think about it from the economist's perspective, it turns out that that copyrights, traditional copyrights, copyrights are things like books, protect something that looks as though the arguments for property are stronger and against it weaker than the things protected by patents. So therefore, it makes sense that we give copyright without even asking, and it lasts practically forever, whereas patent is given very grudgingly and with a fairly short term. So that's another application. So that's one question of property law. What's a property? What's a commons? Why? A different one is, when you own property, what do you own? Because one of the points that I guess was clear to people practicing law for hundreds of years, but I think only became really clear to economists in the last century or so when they started looking at the law, is that when you say you own a piece of land, you are drastically oversimplifying the situation. What you really own is a bundle of rights with regard to that. So I own a piece of land. I do not, as it happens in that particular case, have the right to forbid you from driving your car across my land. Why do I not have that right? My house is a little over 100 years old, and I believe predates Williams Road, which is the street I'm on, and I am told when I bought the house that I own half the width of Williams Road. Now, one of the interesting things, of course, about property law is that if you think of the ownership as a bundle of rights, you can rebundle it. And some previous owner apparently sold to the city of San Jose the right to drive cars across a narrow strip along the edge of my property, which is now the south side of Williams, the south half of Williams Road. But the basic point I'm making is that you own some but not all rights. I don't have the right to forbid American Airlines from flying airplanes above my property, even though the old common law rule was up to the stars and down to the center of the earth. I don't have the right to forbid radio transmissions that cross my property. I don't even have the right to forbid you from honking your horn while driving on my property on Williams Road and thus vibrating air molecules inside my house since I can hear you. So one of the other interesting questions that comes up in law and econ is, what does it make sense to include in the bundle? So why do we define property rights as we do, and what are the mechanisms for rebundling it? So that one way of thinking of property law is, what's your first guess of what things belong in the same bundle? It doesn't do any good to have the right to grow grain on my land if I don't also have the right to walk on the land. It's real hard to cultivate grain without going there. It doesn't do all that much good if I don't have the right to keep you from walking on the land, because the grain doesn't do very well if people have been trampling it down. So you can think about property law as trying to design bundles which contain those rights with regard to a piece of land that belong together. Those rights where the person who owns one of them is probably the one who most values the others. But that's not a perfect system, and part of the beauty of property law is that if it turns out we get it wrong, I can sell you an easement, as the previous owner did for my house, and thus let the right more valuable to you go to you. One of my favorite examples of the fact that what goes into the bundle is not obvious is old property law in the state of Pennsylvania. I think it's changed since, but I'm going to ignore that because it was more interesting then. And the state of Pennsylvania recognized three different estates in land. I should say the crucial fact, which I assume you all know, is that the state of Pennsylvania is made mostly out of coal. And the three rights in the land were the surface right, the mineral right, and the support right. So if I own the surface right and that's all I own, I can stop you from building houses on top of my land, but I cannot stop you from taking all of the coal out from underneath my land with the result that my house falls into your mind. And it then is a matter of contract. If I plan to use the land I own for grazing cattle, well, the risk that maybe at some point there'll be some pits in it that isn't that serious, so maybe I'm willing to sell the support rights, and it's easier for you to mine the coal if you don't have an obligation to make sure that nothing above falls down. Right. On the other hand, if my house is there, I better be sure I own the support right as well as the surface right, and then I can sell the mineral right, so I'm not going to mine that coal. It's valuable. Let me go on to an entirely different question. Let me switch now from property law and tort law to criminal law. And the first question, which nobody but economists would ask, is what's wrong with theft anyway? Because after all, I've been talking in terms of net benefits. I said at the beginning of this that if I pay you a tort judgment of $10,000, if I lose $10,000, you get $10,000, that's a wash in terms of stunt effect and all of that. Well, if I steal $10,000 from you, you lose $10,000, I gain $10,000, that's a wash. What's wrong with that idea? That's the interesting, one of the interesting questions. And there are two answers, one of which is wrong, in my opinion. The right answer is that we've forgotten about incentives. If you have the opportunity, if I have the opportunity to steal $10,000 from you, I am willing to spend anything up to $10,000 to do it. So I'm willing, instead of, well, I could be spending my time doing something useful, teaching law or flipping hamburgers at McDonald's, I'm instead spending all of those hours scouting out likely victims, trying to figure out when you're not going to be at home, making sure where the policeman's route is, and then coming into your house at 2 in the morning and stealing your stuff. In that case, what I steal is money, what you lose is what I gain, but I've also lost all of that time and effort that went to doing it. And if you think it through as an economist, you say, wait a minute, as long as I can, make it mugging instead of burglary for a moment, as long as an hour spent mugging on net makes me more money than an hour spent doing whatever other job I could do, say flipping hamburgers, I will mug, And other people will observe the opportunity and they will mind. Just think of it as an ordinary labor market. It's sort of an odd labor market because it's not a consensual deal. But from the standpoint of the workers in that market, it's just like any other. And you will keep going into a job until people going into it drive down the wage to the point where it's just about as attractive as the other jobs they can take. Right? That standard labor market equilibrium, randomly taking economics. Well, in this case, the mechanism for driving down isn't quite the same because it's not like the victim is offering a wage to the criminal, but it still happens because the more criminals there are, the less stuff lying around that's easily stolen, the more bars are on doors, the more people carry concealed handguns. You can think of all sorts of different ways in which increasing the crime rate reduces the payoff to the individual criminal. That'll go to the point at which the guy who is stealing $10,000 a year is giving up $9,999 a year of alternative employment to do it. So in fact, there's a dead weight loss of about $10,000, not a zero. That's, I think, the right economic answer. But I think it's the wrong answer, and I say this despite a couple of fairly distinguished economists who've argued for it, is to say gains to criminals don't count, and therefore even without the argument I just gave, when I steal $10,000 and you lose $10,000, you are an innocent person who's lost $10,000, I'm a guilty person who's gotten $10,000. We shouldn't want guilty people to be richer, and therefore it's a net social loss of $10,000, and I'm sort of pushed out of the society. The reason that's the wrong answer is that one of the really fascinating things about doing law and econ is seeing if you can get your morals out without putting them in. All right? Instead of saying we already know what, see, implicit in that approach is that we already know what the law should be, that we know that theft should be criminal. But my stealing the new word that you just invented isn't criminal. How did we find that out? All right? And part of the real fun of law and econ is that to a considerable extent, though not perfectly, you can go in with no moral assumptions. You can go in with the very, call it a minimal moral assumption. It would be desirable to maximize the size of the pie. That's in a certain sense, that's utilitarianism, though not exactly. But it's a pretty minimal moral assumption, and come out concluding that murder is bad, theft is bad, and so forth and so on. So you give all that up, and you assume your conclusion at the beginning by saying we already know who are the good guys and the bad guys, and games the bad guys sometimes. So anyway, that's, I think, at least part of the fun. Let me also point out that if you don't do it that way, it's not at all clear when you start interrogating your moral intuitions as to just who counts as bad guys. For example, let's go back to this cap and trade. All right, there's all this sort of semi-moralistic talk about global warming is a terrible thing, putting carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is a terrible thing. Well, I don't know if any of you are planning to stop exhaling soon. I hope not. But human beings do, after all, produce carbon dioxide as part of their metabolism. That's how we run. We burn carbon with oxygen and produce carbon dioxide, and that's what fuels our bodies. That's the first approximation. And therefore, if you really think of emitting CO2 as a criminal activity, then every living human being doesn't seem to make very much sense. And I don't plan to hold my breath until I solve the problem. Let me go on to talk a little bit more about criminal law in a little bit more detail, because one of the interesting issues is what about what an economist would think of offending everybody else as efficient crime. And what I mean by an efficient crime is a ordinarily criminal activity where the gain to the person who does it is greater than the loss of it. And an example which Posner actually, I think, originally proposed is you have a hunter who gets lost in the woods and he's starving. And this is before the days of cell phones. And he comes to a cabin in the woods, and the cabin is locked. Maybe there's even a no trespassing sign on it. And what does he see through the window inside the cabin? A lot of canned beans and a telephone. So what does he do? What any starving person would do in that situation? He breaks into the cabin, sees some beans, calls somebody to fetch him, and if he's an honest man, calls the police to say, by the way, I just broke into this cabin. Do you want to tell me? Well, how we want him to do it. We don't want him to starve. So how do you set up a legal system in which that crime happens, but in which ordinary housebreaking doesn't happen? And there are two answers. One, which is the answer in this particular case, is that we special case. We have something called the doctrine of necessity, and we say, all right, you can show the court that there was a really good reason for you to do something that's normally criminal, so we won't count it as a crime at all. That works for that case. It works probably if the reason I'm breaking the speed limit is that I'm driving my wife to the hospital and she's in the process of giving birth. Because I can point out the fact that the cop who stops me and he'll go ahead and clear the traffic. It doesn't work if the reason I'm going faster than the speed limit is that I'm trying to get to a really important meeting and the small extra risk of an accident that I'm imposing really is substantially less than the gain to me and my employers of my making that meeting, which for some reason or other I'm late for. So in that case, I really can't prove it to the cops of the court. And yet, infringement would like me to speed then too. They're still in that sense. So the solution to that problem is an awful lot like the solution, like the tort law solution. We say we have a punishment. We punish me even for efficient crimes. But we try to set the punishment so that on average I'm paying about the damage done, and now I'll only commit the crime if the benefit to me is larger than damage. And that's the sort of a first approximation story for how criminal law works, with the obvious addition that because we expect that many people who commit crimes don't get caught, we're going to have to scale up the punishment enough so that it's really a sort of a probability punishment lottery that you're facing a certain probability with certain punishment, and that comes out to the equivalent of the punishment. And that, if you're reading law and econ books other than mine, you might be told is how criminal law is supposed to be set up. But then you think about it a little bit further and say, well, that's a very interesting story as far as it goes. We don't deter all murders. Is the reason we don't deter all murders that we believe that the number of murders that occur, let's call it, what is it now, about 5 per 100,000, I think is the average, has gone down a lot 20 or 30 years ago, but still look like 5 murders per 100,000 population per year, that those are all efficient murders. That those are all the ones where the benefit to the murderer is greater than the cost to the victim. And if that isn't what's happening, shouldn't we have a higher penalty for murder? You know, maybe torture people to death or something. It's been done. Right? I mean, if you sort of don't limit yourself to the last century in countries like us, there's been a very wide variety of legal systems that existed. Worth looking at all of them. I have a seminar next semester. We've looked at a bunch of them. Not, I think, any of those. But the point is that if you start thinking a little more carefully, you say, wait a minute, why is it that we don't deter all murders? And the answer, I think, is not that we believe that some of them are efficient. Now, it's true, most of us do believe that some murders are efficient. Most of us can think of one or two people who would leave the world better off by their absence, but they probably aren't the ones who get killed. So what you then start thinking about is, wait a minute, so far I've really been answering, what crimes would you like to prevent if it didn't cost anything to prevent them? What if you have a crime where it does damage of $100? It does a benefit to the criminal of $90. But the cost of using the legal system to stop it is $50. It is inefficient to commit the crime, but it's even more inefficient to prevent it. It's inefficient to commit it, meaning if the criminal wanted to maximize net benefit, he wouldn't commit the crime. But if the rest of the society wants to maximize net benefit, they say, well, look, stopping that is going to require hiring a bunch of cops and building a bunch of prisons, and once in a while arresting innocent people by mistake, because everybody makes mistakes, that cost perhaps is higher than the net cost done by the level of crime. So, yeah, if you read my book, Law and Order, which you can do for free because it's up on the web as well as being sold in many bookstores everywhere, that I run through, especially for those of you who like mathematics, I've on the web version, I've got virtual footnotes which give you links, which takes you to an actual math of it, and you can show that for some cases, the optimal punishment is more than the damage done, in some cases less. And it's less than the damage done where you don't want to deter only mildly inefficient crimes because it costs more to deter them than the damage done. And it's more than the damage done when you want to deter even some efficient crimes because if you deter a crime, you don't have to punish it. So it turns out to depend on the elasticity of supply of offenses. Let me go on, we're still running a bit short of time, but let me go on to talk about another issue related to that, and that's the question of the choice of punishment. Because I mentioned earlier that execution is a less inefficient punishment than imprisonment, because execution only costs the guy his life, doesn't cost the rest of us anything other than, you know, a bullet or a lethal injection or something, whereas imprisonment costs him the punishment and costs us the cost of maintaining. And that starts you thinking about the question of why we have the structure of punishments we have. and the way of thinking about it that I find useful is they suppose we could show that there's some particular crime for which now we give 10 years in prison. And suppose that with a little bit of social science research, we could discover that the criminals are indifferent between 10 years in prison with certainty and execution with one chance in six. All right, there's going to be some such measure. People take risks. These are both large costs. Execution is most likely the larger cost. It's not infinitely larger. So let's say that that's the way the numbers show. Well, I've got this very simple way of concluding how it goes. Every time we convict somebody of this crime, we roll a dice. 1 to 5, we send them home. 6, we hang them. Now, there are lots of things, and I'm going to avoid the whole issue of what's called incapacitation, the fact that if you lock them up, at least for 10 years, you can only commit crimes when people are inside the prison, whereas if you send them home, you can commit other crimes over here, if you hang them, you can never commit any crimes again. So it's not clear how that comes out. But the more interesting question is, why don't we do it that way? And of course, you can go further, because if you take seriously the idea of picking those punishments that give the lowest net cost per amount of punishment, it then looks as though things like not only execution, but flogging, or we can do better than that, penal slavery, right? After all, penal slavery, at least in societies where slavery can be run at a profit, which has been true of some, not all historical societies, not only does the criminal lose his liberty, other people get his labor as a result, so it looks as though it's more efficient than execution. Or if we want to take a modern high-tech version, have mortgages worth it. All right? And what's wrong with that argument? And what's wrong with that argument, in my view, is that we've thought about the incentives of the criminal, but not about the incentives of the enforcement system. And it turns out that this point was made by a very bright science fiction writer by the name of Larry Niven long before I made it in an article in the Journal of Political Economy. And Niven has a series of stories which start out in our near future when people start observing there's a shortage of organs for transplants. And they say, look, isn't it wasteful that when we execute people, which we sometimes do, we just bury them? After all, execution is the ideal situation for harvesting an organ, because you've got the guy when he's alive, and you can get it, you know, fresh 2 seconds after you kill him. You can take, you know, whatever organs are still useful, and that way, not only do we prevent crime with execution, which we're doing already, we also save lives. Great idea. And in his fictional future, the idea spreads like wildfire, and more countries start doing it. And then what do you think happens next? Well, there's still an organ shortage. And if there's still an organ shortage, well, we're not really sure that that crime is serious enough to execute for. But on the other hand, we could save 2 or 3 lives if we did. And the result is, in his future, that more and more crimes become capital. And in the story which started this series, you eventually discover that the protagonist who is sitting in prison waiting to be executed has been convicted of, for a third time, driving in such a way as to endanger human life. So it's a three strikes law. Three dangerous drivers to be here. And I thought that was a very good point. It was the same point I made in my article in a different form. Namely, that to the extent you have really efficient punishment, the people imposing the punishment gain by doing so, and that affects their intent. And then once you start thinking about it that way, you realize that that's a real issue in our legal system. That's what at least people worry about with regard to punitive damages, with regard to class action. They worry that because the incentive to punish, as it were, is too high, you will do your best to punish people even if they aren't guilty in the hopes that you can collect money from them. For a slightly less obvious case, it's the problem with civil forfeiture. As you may know, under current U.S. law, you can have property seized from you with no evidence that you have committed any crime at all and done under a preponderance of the evidence standard of proof. What happens is it is proved that the property committed a crime. That's only a slightly metaphorical way of putting it, that the property was used to violate the law in certain ways, and therefore the property was. And as you may know, the Supreme Court case on this one, which I think emphasizes the fact that it has nothing to do with the guilt of the owner, involved a man who picked up a prostitute using a car that he jointly owned with his wife. The car forfeited. The wife attempted to get her share of it back and paid. So she was, in some sense, the victim of the crime, in as much as he was breaking his contract with her, and yet she was getting punished for it. Well, what's wrong with that? There are arguments for it. Clearly, it gives an incentive for police to go after people, but it gives an incentive for the wrong people to go after the deep pockets rather than the people who are really sick. So that's an issue which we're not to worry about. Let me actually tell you one of my medieval Islamic law and econ stories, because it in fact is a law and econ story. It's a real medieval Islamic story, but it makes the point about incentive to enforce from the other side. The poet Ibn Harman performed before the Prince of the Muslims, and so delighted was the caliph with his performance that he said, "Name your reward." And Ibn Harman said, "What I wish for the Prince of the Muslims is that he sends instructions to his officials in the city of Medina, commanding that when I am found dead drunk upon the pavement and brought in by the city guard, I be let off from the punishment prescribed for that offense." And the Prince of the Muslims answered, "That is God's law, not mine. I cannot change it. It's a Quranic rule, so not under the Caliph's authority. Name another reward." And Ibn Harman said, "There is nothing else I desire for the Prince of the Muslims." And the Caliph thought a little, and he then sent instructions to his officials in the city of Medina that whenever anybody found the poet Ibn Harman drunk upon the pavement and brought him in, Ibn Harman should receive 60 strokes of the lash as the law required. But whoever brought him in should receive it. And ever after, when anyone saw the poet drunk upon the pavement, he would turn to his companion and say, "80 for 60 is a bad one." Isn't that a wonderful story? Because the point is, you can't change the law, but you can change the incentive to enforce the law, which is exactly what he's doing. Alright, I'm sort of running out of time, so let me very quickly go through some more points. The next one is that one of the really interesting questions that you again don't think about in law school, but should, is why we have both tort law and criminal law. Because if you step back, they're really doing about the same thing through different mechanisms. One of them privately prosecuted by the victim, one of them publicly prosecuted by the state. The point was made particularly clear when O.J. Simpson was first acquitted of the crime of killing his wife and then convicted of the tort of killing his wife. So the interesting question is, do we need both systems? And the answer is no. You can point at historical societies that in effect had a pure tort system where if you killed somebody, his relatives sued you, or a pure criminal system where if you broke a contract, basically you were reported to the police, loosely speaking. Is it desirable to have both? If we have both, does it make sense to divide offenses the way we do, to treat certain things as torts and certain things as crimes? And does it make sense to divide legal rules as we do, to have certain legal rules as an intent required for a crime but not a tort, and so forth? And that's a very interesting set of questions that I don't have time to go into now, but I spend about a chapter on it in Law and Order. I already made my point about economics and justice, that part of the fun of this analysis is saying, let's make very minimal assumptions about all we want and see if a lot of our moral intuitions turn out to make sense in those terms. So far, I've said very little about what economists learn from the law. And the answer is quite a lot. That one of the most important economic articles, I suppose, in the last 50 years was an article by Ronald Coase, which basically demonstrated that the Goo's view of externality was wrong. That what everybody else in the field accepted was wrong. This wonderful story, true story, that he went to have, he came here to Chicago to give a talk on this subject. He had dinner at Aaron Director's house with a bunch of other economists, of whom I don't know, five or six of them should have Nobel Prizes. At the beginning of the dinner, the argument was 17-1 against Coase, and at the end it was 18-0 for Coase. Which is one of the reasons he got a Nobel Prize. But in any case, that was a case where Coase had looked at how the law treated externality issues, which is in part the law of nuisance as well as tort law, and concluded that Pigou had misconceptualized the problem, and therefore that his solution would sometimes make things worse, not better, and that without his solution, the problem would sometimes solve itself and sometimes wouldn't, and that the real nature of the problem is different. And again, that would take more time than I have. So that's been very useful. This has been a very, very brief sketch. As I say, this is the Cliff Notes version of the course. So if you want more, I'm not teaching the course this year, but I'll be teaching it next year for those of you who are still around next year. I teach it every other year. If I persuade enough people to take it, I'll teach it every year, but it hasn't been worth it so far. And if you don't feel like taking the course, my webpage is, I don't see it, something right there. My webpage is www.davidgfriedman.com.
www.thewebversion.com. And if you go there and look around, you can find a link to the web version of Law's Order, as well as the link to web versions of a couple of my other books. Thanks, everybody.